the sixth chapter of Daniel. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom, and over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give account unto them, and the king should have no damage. Then this Daniel was prepared above the presidents and princes, because an accident spirit within him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. Then the presidents and princes thought to find occasion against Daniel. Verse 6. Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said unto him, King Darius, live forever. And then you have their petition. They request that no prayer be offered to any god, verse the end of verse 7, or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king. He shall be cast, if you do pray against to any other god, they'll be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing, that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Wherefore King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went unto his house, and his windows being open to his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day in prayer, and gave thanks before his God, as he did aforetime. Then these men assembled, and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Verse 13. Then answered they and said before the king, that Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petition 3 times a day. Then the king, when he heard these words, was full displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree or statute which the king establisheth may be changed. Then they have him cast into the den of lions. Now look on verse 20. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God whom thou servest continually able to deliver thee from the lions? Verse 22, my God hath sent his angel and hath shut the lion's mouth. Verse 26, I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. Verse 28. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Now, chapter 7. This starts a new section in the book. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions of his head upon his bed, and he wrote the dream, and told the sum of the matters. And Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens drove upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion. Verse 5, and another beast, a second, like to a bear. Verse 6, and after this I beheld and knew another, like a leopard. And verse 7, after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, on it are 10 horns. Now that, I think, shall three, four, five, eight. One chapter alone is used in this prophecy to describe things under the new empire, the Medo-Persian empire. I judge that one great lesson the Lord would teach us is this, that though you may change rules in power and may alter laws and regulations, the heart of man changes little, and the ways of men are still cruel. I don't think anyone would doubt that reads this sixth chapter of Daniel. The Persian rule differed greatly from the rule of Nebuchadnezzar. I think we've tried to make plain, I hope we've done it, that when Nebuchadnezzar made decrees, he made his own decisions. He acted in his own responsibility. And that's real government. That's real law. He was a ruler, but he said he carried out. When it comes to Persian rule, for that's not as good a rule as you have in Nebuchadnezzar. We may have found it wearisome to read through all that list of names of princes and governors and controllers. The king is not an absolute authority. And it is not the power that Nebuchadnezzar was. But that he's forced to do things by those underneath him. And that he's swayed by the governors and others in the land. Now, that's an important principle to the man. There's nothing more important to understand that the child of God, that those who rule do it. I hope you understand that now.
The brother is not in Belfast. That's something that the executive said, oh, the governor get out. And no, that was true, but maybe he was not the point there.
I'm the ruler of this.
What do you mean by that?
Well, here is a king, and he's ruling. He's supposed to be ruling, and as we'll see in a moment, he was supposed to be God in the land. And yet he's only doing what others tell him to do. Here's a man. He's making decisions, but the decisions are not his own. And he's signing documents that he replaced afterwards that he had signed.
That's Persian rule. That's not as high a standard as the upper class rule that we were studying in connection with Congress. Then again, I think you will see, Santana, most representative in our chapter, we have to see the typical side of us before Dr. Huntsman was in that way here. Santana, the Jew, the prophet of the Lord, he's getting on in years now. Don't let us forget that. Beginning to be an old man. He may have been there now yet at this time.
But he has the spirit in him that the others haven't. And the king is wise enough. In this respect, that he can detect qualities in Daniel that he can't find in others.
Men even are not very able themselves. They find it somebody that's interested. And somebody they can depend upon. I think that's true in all circles.
He had a man in his realm that he really put confidence in. And it was in his mind not only to give him a place along with those other three princes, but to actually put him over the whole show.
Now you would know right well that the Jews in a heathen court would be looked upon with a jealous eye even to have any position.
But then for a Jew to be viewed as not only equal with the others in high society, but to be actually put over the whole realm.
And that was very bitter a pill for these jealous-minded men to swallow.
And what did they do? They set to their thinking to try and ruin the man that God had honored and the man that the king had confidence in.
It's more difficult than that under England. For the simple reason is that they could see that all possessions in the kingdom were definitely.
And that there's nobody to question his behavior. And they could see the hopelessness of trying to find fault with him along that line. But if we can't knock him down that way, we try another way. and that is we'll deal with him, we'll get a touch of him by the way he serves his God. We'll try and prove his weakness in the religious realm.
Because you see, if he do what we want him to do, he have denied his religion.
And he will have denied his faith in his God. And he's been just the same as the rest of us, because we have no such God as Daniel has, and our God couldn't tell us how to read writings the way Daniel has been instructed to read them, and so on, and so we'll be all in a level then. We'll bring him down from his excellency. We'll bring him down from the place he has played. Now, there were shrewd thinkers. Very shrewd thinkers. You know, these men don't get jobs like this without some measure of ability. And their thoughts were in this relevant. If we can deify the king and make him think that he's God for a month and allow no prayer to ascend for any other God but him, and if anyone dares to pray to another God other than to the king, that man will have to be put into the den of lions.
The precepts of God are clear that different empires had different ways of executing people. In the Jewish realm, it was death by stoning. You men know that. And if there was hanging involved, it was the hanging up of the corpse, not death by hanging in the sense that we understand it. Hope I'm right in that, but that's what I judge it to be.
When it was a case of goblin, we can see it was roasting in the fire.
Put them into the furnace.
Now, when it's the Persian method of slaughter, it's put them into the wild beast in the den of lions. Now, all this is very important. All this is showing us the qualities of man. And at the same time, the recklessness of their behavior. Now, they had their, we might was going to say, their teeth watered for to get Daniel into the den. Well, then, for us, we'll bring him down from his excellency. Now, I want us to see very clearly that the king never thought, when he was making the decree and signing the document, that he was putting himself into such difficulty. I wish this chapter had been studied by every overseer in God's assemblies. Because many a time decisions are made in oversight meetings, and when the real consequences are understood, those who made those decisions have been sorry to make them. It's all right signing something until you're faced with it in a circumstance you never expected. I hope your mind's big enough to take that in. Watch your decisions, brethren, because you know when you're not, then you're too proud likely to go back on them. And it's very difficult to get an oversight to say we're wrong. Get an individual to say that. But getting an oversight to admit they made a mistake is very difficult. It's like the laws of the Medes and Persians. It can hardly be altered. So watch decisions when you're making them. Then again, I would like you to notice that Daniel learns of this decree. And it was signed as the result of a tumultuous assembling. Now, you men may not have noticed it, but in your chapter, three times over, the expression used, assembled, assembled, assembled. It's used in connection with the signing of the decree. It's used in the testing Daniel in his prayer life. It's used in getting the king to carry out the threat that cannot be altered according to the laws of the Medes and Persians. Now that word assembled is the same as the word raised or tumultuously assembled in Psalm number 2. It's not just merely that they went in a collective way, but they went in with haste and with rush, and with, we may say, boldness into the presence of the king, and they went in there determined, and raging, and excited, all to get their ends accomplished.
reminding us of those words that I'm hinting at already in Psalm 2. Where do the heathen rage, and their peoples imagine a vain thing? There's the whole assembly, as it were, against Daniel. And when that is done, the king, of course, signs it, and Daniel hears about it. Now, this is where the test comes in. He didn't go out onto the street and make a public prayer in protest. You know, look at this, these for protest. You get a placard up or do something, you've always to protest. This is the, we're protesting. But Daniel made no protest. He didn't go out and show off what he could do or one thing or another. He was no fool along those lines. But just went on his usual way. Went into his room, opened his window toward Jerusalem, and got down on his knees and prayed as he did a full time. Dear brother, I want to tell you, there's no use of you trying to pray in a crisis if you haven't done it before. You understand that? Daniel had known something of prayer and the power of prayer in his earlier life, and so when it came to the crisis, he could still get down on his knees and he could pray. Kneeling to pray, not always necessary, you know, for the Bible speaks of let men stand and pray, lifting up holy hands without wrath and burden. When a believer kneels to pray, he's bowing down in acknowledgement of his helplessness and his weakness. It's a confession by his very posture that he is dependent upon his God. And he gets down and he prays, and having in mind now the Book of Kings, where Solomon prayed that if anywhere in trouble, in a poor land, if there were pray toward this house, the God which was to hear them in heaven is dwelling place. You know, it's great not only to pray, but the knowledge of your Bible when you're praying. So here's a man, and the knowledge he has of the Bible is guiding him in his prayer life. Just somebody wanted to open the window for sure, but he kept the window closed, for there's no glass in windows those days. They would not have known a thing, they wouldn't have known a thing about it. He could have his food for aid coming, and so be quietness. But you see, he wouldn't have been fulfilling what he had learned from his Bible. Not in distress in a foreign land, men were to open their window, and they were to look, or not, they were to look toward the temple of Jerusalem. Now, there was no temple to look to. Don't misunderstand me. There was no literal temple, for it was already burnt and destroyed. But still, they would look toward that holy spot where God had placed his name. Now, I'll put it another way. To help you, just in all simplicity, when you're praying, you're turning your thoughts to God, to heaven, and to home. Those lovely words, aren't they most sweet to us as we read them in John 17? Jesus lifting up his eyes. One person of the Godhead speaking to the other and gazing up into glory as he did so. And dear saints of God, isn't it great that when we're down on our knees and when we're praying either in private or in public, that we're actually addressing the very throne of God and speaking right to his dwelling place as we do so. On your bread. The Christians, to hear him at it. That's assembled again to hear him at it, you know. They wanted that to be true. And they were delighted to see that he was still carrying on with his prayer. Why? Because that would take to the king, and the king would have to carry out his decree. Reluctant to reward. But he had to do it. We make sure he does. Because he'll have to keep to the laws of the Medes and Persians that can't be altered. And so they go to the king, and they tell the story quite clearly. This Daniel, they neither will judge you, nor anything else. He has no respect for you, and he's praying to his own God, and he's doing it 3 times a day. And we'll have to put him into the den of lions, because that's what you've said. That was heavy tidings to the king, for he had no intention of putting him in. Little did he think when he was signing the document He was going to do this. This was going to be the outcome. He had gone to extreme. He had allowed men. Now listen carefully, brother. He had allowed men to blow him up to think he was a god. Some people. Now listen, brother, that's terribly true. If you give them enough wind, you can really get them to do anything. I wonder if we were going to it. Are we all in for it? Blow it up! I'm not saying anything for you. You do anything for it. That's sad, isn't it? Isn't that sure witness in a ruler? That if he's not in him enough, you'll get anything you want out of him? That's sad. Now then, you're in the boat! And you're in the boat for a month! Just as you could be a god for a month, and wouldn't be another one, and next month you wouldn't be. Like the thing's so silly, but there they are. That's human reason, you know. You must pray to him or nobody else. And isn't it strange, brother? Oh, take a look at that. Here's a man and they have deified him for a month. And yet he can't even deliver Daniel from the den of lions. What he would want to do. He's just as helpless as a child, even though he's been made to believe he's a god. Now you see, I hope you've noticed enough in your Bible to know that whether you look at Egypt or Babylon, or whether you look at Media Persia, or whatever land you look at, of those great empires, the last word that a man wants is to be worshipped by his fellow. Now you will know, I hope you know enough, that this is the outcome of the future great man that will rise to control the world in the days of tribulation after the church has been raptured. He will sit in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. And that's what the Jews in the very place that Daniel was in this chapter. Doesn't that mean that the faithful will either have to wear his mark and own him as their God, or else, if they do that, of course they're not the faithful, but either that or suffer the consequences. I want to learn from this chapter, because making the rise God for a month is a picture of the claims of the Antichrist in a coming day. Are you hearing that? That's the prophetic side of it now. Get a hold of that, because it's not just us through this. It's a prophetic forecast, forecasting the future. Then you see, what does Daniel represent? Daniel represents those who will be hidden by God and preserved in that critical period and kept alive when we might well have thought they were dead. Now, you must also illustrate it in the book of Jonah. You know, when those mariners took Jonah and threw him overboard, he thought he was dead. He had disappeared out of sight. But you know, right there, he appeared on the streets of Nineveh after a period. He was still alive. And you see, many will be thinking in those days of tribulation that the nation of Israel has been wiped out. That there's not the blame of God will be mentioned. But just as sure as Jonah come out of the throats of the fish, and as sure as Daniel came out of the lion's den, so sure will the nation of Israel rise up in that figure of resurrection that's so wonderfully described in Ezekiel as the body of dry bones standing up like a mighty army. No, God has them hidden, and God will have them hidden in a special way. If we were looking at Revelation, we would see that the woman which represents the remnant in the latter days will be hidden for 3.5 years or 42 months in the wilderness. God will hide his own until the day of their deliverance comes. Now, the king seems to think that God will do something for Daniel. He didn't say to Daniel, "Are you eager just with me and I deal with those boys?" I'll put them all down and put you up.
It's ours to do that.
But it says the God that you serve, Daniel, he'll do something for you. And that's your journey. That old man, you know, sad sight, isn't it? Now, be honest about him. You know, you some people used to think when they're reading this story that he's just a young fellow threw in among the lions. Not at all. They cast him into the den of lions. He looked into the lion's face, but he looked into the face of Nebuchadnezzar as a boy. Of course, remember, Nebuchadnezzar was like a lion, as we see in a short time.
But now he's looking into the literal lion's face.
He spent the night with them. And I was going to tell you something, and I think you'd all agree with it. He spent a better night with the lions than the king spent in his bed. For the king couldn't rest, and he couldn't sleep, and he was all distressed. Now, get a hold of this dear child of God.
But the lions were out. Couldn't work without divine liberty to do so.
I hope you notice those cases in your Bible where the creatures act differently to nature. Have you noticed that? Have you connected together the talking of the donkey to Balaam? And that's against nature, isn't it?
Have you noticed those ravens that didn't eat the beast and the fruit that they brought to Elijah?
You notice that? That's a very unusual thing to do. But you know a raven, would be glad of a piece of meat, but they were bringing it over. There were messengers, but they dropped it down and left it for Elijah to eat.
And now here are lions' mouths closed. Acting contrary to nature.
Every dear child of God, you have never understood that you have a nature within you that needs divine control.
That man needs to know when to open their mouths,
just like our beast did, able to know.
That men have to realize that only divine power can preserve them from gratifying their appetites.
Like those words. And that only divine power at times can keep our mouths closed and keep us from devouring one another. You know, they needed something like that at Galatia, where it says if you bite and devour one another,
it's not about it the way the lambs were there. But how would we stop biting? And how would we stop devouring?
Well, it says, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. Divine control can help us to keep our mouths shut and keep us from devouring one another. And nothing less will do. Now, well, then, you know, when we begin to get beastly in our practices, it's a dreadful thing for people to say they're saved, and then they're starting to fight and devour one another. Cannibalism wouldn't suit a Christian in any degree whatever. Then again, you will notice that the king comes early in the morning to see the king, to see the den. He's quite sure he's seen that Daniel's going to be alive. At least he assumes that. And he calls to him, and Daniel comes out, and he calls him out.
Oh, the seal had been put on the stone. Mind you, those boys made sure Daniel wouldn't get out. They put the stone on, and the seal, and they said he's there to stay.
And you could hardly read that, you know, but you'd read about the tomb, wouldn't you? When the other enemy was involved, the enemy death, and Jesus was buried in the tomb, and they sealed it with their seal, the Roman seal, and they set the watch, and out from it all, Jesus came in resurrection power. And out from this, then comes Daniel in resurrection power. I think that's clear. Now, look, dear souls, the greatest and darkest day in Daniel's life made him more like his Lord than any time in his life before.
Well, that's a big lesson in our life. That Joseph was never more like his Lord than when he was bound in the prison. And Daniel was never more like his Lord than when he was put into the den of lions. Yes, dear saints of God, those things that we resent and dread and fear most powerfully
are the very things that often change, bring us into lane with thoughts of God and with the knowledge of God and the knowledge of Christ. Now, what's going to be there?
Daniel, what are you? The king makes a decree. And what has happened now? I hope we're clear enough in all our thinking in Daniel. And that is this. The God of Daniel is known to the Persians. The missionary has done his work. He has left an empire now. But they'll hear of the God of Israel. As to his might, as to his power, and as to his wondrous glory. You'll notice in that decree the different points that the king raises. He speaks of God as the living God, and he's a God to be feared, and he's a God who will deliver his own, and very specially, he's a God who has a kingdom that will never come to an end. And you see the amount of truth that was taught a Gentile man just by the right behavior of a humble prophet doing the will of God. That is, Daniel went into the den and he left the issues with God. I wonder, dear saints of God, when will we learn? And I wonder, I'm speaking out of my own breast. When will we learn that it's ours to do what's right and leave the issues with God? We're not expected to intervene. We can't do anything. What could Daniel do with a den of lions? You know, we used to talk about Daniel in the lion's den. I could bring the lion's den myself so long as there's no lions in it. But Daniel was put into the lions in the den. What's that for Daniel doing an old man where perhaps around the 18 mark? What could he do with these lions? Only just leaving self in their hands. But they were powerless to touch him. I mean, it wasn't these men's new teeth and that they had no power. But the three men, the boys that opposed Daniel on the throne of the people. Well, the old law that we were at last night, I hope you haven't forgotten what you heard in the meeting last night. The old law of reaping whatsoever you sow is written across the Persian Empire just as clearly as it's across the Babylonish one.
Here are men, and they're reaping what they have sown. They were against Daniel, and they were good and tear to pieces with a lion.
But the very teeth that they expected to tear Daniel were the teeth that tore an end of it and destroyed them in the presence of the king. Now, he got this now. Here's the last look we get of the Persian Empire in this prophecy. The last historical event. Now, didn't you notice that we summed up this in the previous chapter when we came to the end of the Babylonian kingdom? Aramna. Now here's it in a nutshell. When the millennial kingdom is established and all Gentile rule has come to an end, God, the God of Israel, will be the God that will be known by Gentiles. Those who have hated and opposed the faithful in those trying days will suffer and be the subjects of divine judgment. Don't let us forget that. They'll go to everlasting punishment, those who have rejected the testimony of the weak and needy and helpless, trusting in God in those days. And then Daniel promoted to honor. Oh yes, dear friend. The men may despise the Jew, you know, and the men may make little of the Israelites, and the men may think very little of that empire, that nation, which is not an empire by any means, one of the weak nations of the world. But remember, God has destined that nation will rise supreme, and the faithful among them will yet reign with Christ and be honored for their faithfulness in that coming day. Get those stretches into your mind, and we'll help you in the study of this prophecy. Now, when we come to chapter 7, because I want to get through as much as I can in the nights that are at our disposal, we're in an entirely different line of things altogether. We're simply dealing now with what we might call prophetic visions. The historical part has come to an end in the book. Now, keep that in mind. I hope I've said enough. I hope you're not ruling with me saying it. I hope I have emphasized it clearly that the historical part is no less prophecy than the other part.
But the prophecy in the one case is demonstrated by the happenings that were taking place, whereas in these chapters it will be visions and communications from God to the prophet. And that's why you notice that the historical order in the book is upset. We've just finished with the Persian emperor in chapter 6. Now we go back to the Babylonian woman. You say, but the poor man must have made a mistake in writing his book. He should have put this chapter in there and put the other one all around. Not at all. What we're going now to see is God's communication to this man Daniel during the period of the Babylonian kingdom and the insight that he had into God's dealings during the end of the Babylonian empire. Now, briefly, tonight we want you to see, try and retain it if you can, that the first vision that Daniel got was a vision of 4 hours. Anyone reading it will know that those 4 animals correspond to the 4 metals that were mentioned in the 2nd chapter. They describe the empires, but under different figures. When Daniel is seeing them, he sees their beastly character. He's seeing the inside of them everywhere. He's seeing their very nature. When Nebuchadnezzar was seeing those empires, they were glittering gold and shining silver and brazen. They were just the outward side of things. That's all he was seeing. Whereas Daniel's getting a look at the same empires, but he's seeing them in their nature. In their very nature, in their inner life, as it were, another view of the same object. You know, dear child of God, don't you forget that much that looks splendid and beautiful in the eyes of men, when God Almighty sees it as like a heap of corruption. Don't forget that. The world in splendor and glory may be the object of admiration by thousands. Thousands may feel that's wonderful, that's a glorious sight. But if you could only see the corruption that's behind it, and the evil that's in it, how much that goes on the world and passes for a great show is just a heap of iniquity, and God sees it in that deep and real way. Now take a look at these empires under these figures, and we'll take a look at them briefly. The first one is a lion. Now, you'll have to admit, when you're reading these chapters, that the lion's not an ordinary beast that you would meet in the forest. It wasn't like the ones in the den. Because it has got wings on its back. And anybody knows, whatever lions I have seen are pictures of them. I never saw ones with wings on them before. It has wings like an eagle. And it has an iron gallery. And that, of course, is simply demonstrating to us Nebuchadnezzar and the founding of the Babylonian Empire. Like a mighty lion, he came in, he roared, and he scattered, and he subdued, and he brought nations under his power. But he had wings at the same time, that is, he was able to do it swiftly. You notice that? He's equipped with wings. So that he moved over the face of the earth and subdued one after the other. And then you notice that the second beast. Ah, but some of the second beast has no wings on it. No, it hasn't. It's the Medo Persian Empire. And it's not likened to a lion that's swift and fruit and sharp in its judgment and all that. No, no. It's likened to a big clumsy bear. But you know the bears, the way they just rule about. The wings on it. Slowly crushing all before it. Now, of all the empires that were established, the Persian was the one that had the largest armies, huge masses of men, illustrated by the bear here, going slowly, taking places slowly, and 3 ribs in its mouth. It has destroyed 4 other animals, as it were, in picture. That is, it has destroyed the
Egyptian area, and it had destroyed the Babylonish empire that we've already mentioned, and perhaps Central Asia as well. That is the Persian Empire. Slowly, slowly, but surely became powerful. And brought and obtained its end in its empire. Then you have the next one is a panther, or a, I guess a leopard, maybe in the authorized version. That's all right. I don't argue. I don't know much. It doesn't make much difference. And you know, it is another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings. Now, take a note of the wings. Because the panther was illustrating the Grecian Empire and the establishment of the Greek or the Grecian or Macedonian Empire was the fastest of all. It's a drawing. You know, Alexander, the famous Alexander the Great, he just left the country. He just at us. The he goat that we learn about later on, but that's another figure that's used about him. The he goat ran fast through the country and swept over nation after nation and subdued them one after the other. But you say there should be four.
Yes, there are four.
What do you call this next animal? Well, you'd have to tell me, for the Bible doesn't call it that animal. It's diverse from all animals. There's not another animal in the world can match it, or that you can use as an illustration of it. It has everything, you might say, that is different to the ordinary animals that we are acquainted with. And you notice that a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, that's the iron. It had great iron teeth, that reminds us of the iron in the image, doesn't it? The iron teeth, and it stomped the, it devoured and break in pieces, and stomped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, here we're landed right into the Roman Empire. That awful, powerful empire that spread abroad and thumped down everything. Great idea with strength and power. And it embraced, as we said the other night, a very wide territory. But you notice that the last description of it almost is this, that it has got 10 horns. Now this would be a big subject in the prophecy that we're dealing with, and especially in the book of Revelation. Because you see, those 10 horns correspond to the 10 toes that we were at in chapter 2. There's no big understanding about that. 10 horns, you say, what are horns? Horns are strength. Kings are powers. Well, you know the beast's strength lies in its horn. It's a lack of strength. Those 10 horns evidently will come into action or come into view toward the end of the Roman Empire in its revived form. Now, what we have to consider is this now. Please don't waste your time in trying to find out 10 nations that compose the Roman Empire. For you boys are intelligent enough to know that there are far more than 10 of them. In the past. You have to agree to that. Don't be arguing against that. Because the Roman Empire included a good part of Asia. It went right around Egypt. It covered all the Mediterranean and right over to Great Britain, almost into Scotland. Could you not count up more than 10? I'm looking at these men here at the front because they would maybe have the notion in the head that now, if we can get the 10 countries that made up the Roman Empire in the past, we'll have got the 10 countries that will make up the Roman Empire in the future. And you couldn't be more stupid in your Bible than that. Now, that's maybe crude, but you bear with it. That's not the right way to look at it. No, no. Anybody knew that when you're looking at the image, the toes were the last bit of it. You didn't need to be a scholar to see that. And anyone knows that when you're looking at these horns, you're looking at the great revived Roman Empire in the future.
And out of those horns will grow up another horn that they're going to speak upon in the will of God tomorrow night. In other words, the beast that rises out of the sea in the 13th chapter of Revelation will be the 11th horn, the little horn of Daniel. Daniel chapter 7. We have to leave that. Now, I hope we can see that Daniel sees these beasts rising one after another. That is, as one empire disappears, another one comes into view. And he mentions certain little features about them, so that we could detect what is up. For instance, he says the bear had one shoulder up and the other down. One shoulder higher than the other. Some of us have that, you know, we don't like it. But I mean, the bear had that. And anybody knows, you see, that while the media was the oldest part of the empire, the Medo-Persian empire, that the Persians are glad as it were, and they become the predominant part of it. You see, sure, God can picture things. And show clearly to Daniel, even in the days of Belshazzar, he would not only show him that there would be a Persian emperor, but show that it would be lopsided, that the one power higher than the other. That's before there is at all. You see, we need to know that God foresaw that the Persians would be superior to the Medians, and that they would be definitely the greater nation of the two that would combine and make the empire. God foresaw that. And God foresaw these three bones, you know. And was the three bones in the mouth of the bear. God foresaw that the Muslims that would be overcome. All this is very vividly pictured for us. Clearly pictured for us. We only need to have a look at it, as it were, to see how vivid are the descriptions and how important are what are the words that are used. Every little detail is foreseen by God. The future program, we don't have time to speak on it tonight. The future program is very interesting. Light's very short with us, and it's very difficult for us in a short lifetime to get a hold of prophetic truth. You only get about 50 years out of it, maybe 60 at the most. You say, I could learn geography in 60 years, or I could learn Latin in 60 years, or I could learn French in 60 years. Well, now I can tell you that it'll take the whole 60, if you're spared the 60, to get a proper understanding of prophetic truth. It's a slow thing to understand. But what will amaze men in days to come will be not only that God foresaw the future and prophesied concerning it, but was so detailed in what he had said. Now it's the details of it that arouses our interest, isn't it? Little things that we would never think about. Or when we say, for example, what we've been looking at in picture form tonight, when all those who have been under the beast and who have been preserved by God, there'll be an amazement at how many were kept alive when everybody thought they were slain because of their faithfulness. And you know the way it's worded in the 49th of Isaiah. Where did it come from? Look, they're flying the ghosts to the windows. Somebody sees another a prophetic reference to the airplane. You see them flying the ghosts to the window. Where are they coming from? They're coming out of their holy places. Until they are on the holy hold it. We wonder where we get houses for them. We wonder where we get places for them. Don't you see, dear friend, God is a wonderful God. The same God that took Noah out of the ark and his family and populated the earth from that small household. That same God that took Daniel out of the den of lions and that brought the Hebrew Jews from the burning fiery furnace
will bring his faithful ones out in that coming day to set up his kingdom. And just as sure as Noah was honored as he stood up on the earth and gave God the glory, and as sure as those Hebrew Jews were honored that came out and gave God the glory, and sure as Daniel was honored and came out and gave God the glory, the faithful remnant in the future will come forth. Come forth to share with the Lord in his kingdom. Now we'll see this maybe tomorrow night, God willing, that it's the saints that take the kingdom. You know, he will not wear his crown alone. He wants others to share his glory with him. My blessed Lord is not jealous in any sense, nor he's not all exclusive to himself in any sense. He wants to share with others the honors that he has won and the victories that have become his. May the Lord help us to learn from our Bibles until the world will get small and small. Many a time I look at young men, I'm dropping out my subject and I see them. Mind you, the world's big when you're young, doesn't it? Mind you, you're thinking it's wonderful, don't you? You think it'd be great if you could get a great position in the world, or you could amass wealth, or you could do well in business, or you could accomplish a lot. And you know, when all's over, dear friend, it's just so much mud on your boots, and so much that you'll have to say goodbye to when the end comes or the Lord appears. God help us to be satisfied, to be humble, and at the same time to learn the lessons that God intends us to learn in the very trials through which he may call us.